walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Nicole Forsyth, President and CEO of Red Rover, a Sacramento-based national organization dedicated to rescue and sheltering animals in crisis. Founded in 1987, though with a different name, Red Rover's efforts are focused on animals left behind during natural disasters, providing financial assistance for emergency care, offering support for local animal advocates, and devoting itself to other causes and issues as they arise. Forsyth has served as president and CEO since 2006, and while leading Red Rover, she's doubled its budget, expanded the staff, and helped implement new programs. Red Rover has deployed a squad of volunteers and often veterinarians to storms ranging from Hurricane Harvey to Katrina, amongst other crises where animals and their humans need help of one kind or another. We'll hear about the history, evolution, and current mission, as well as portions of Nicole's own story when I speak with Nicole Forsyth in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later in the show, I'll speak with Chris Rusinak of Nature's Classroom, an environmental education center in Hillsborough County that's holding its annual Woods, Water, and Wildlife open house this Saturday, April 28th. Right now, though, let's get to Nicole with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Nicole Forsyth on Talking Animals. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thanks for having me on.
You bet. So Red Rover, as I kind of noted in the introduction, has been around for more than 30 years, but until recently, I'm embarrassed to say, I was unfamiliar with the organization. To what extent is my experience in that way not uncommon?
It's definitely common, and we're trying to change that. So being on shows like this is a great way to get the word out for us. We're a fairly small organization for being national, so that's been a challenge, and we're really working to change that.
So in addition to being on shows like this, which I appreciate that, the Red Rover's work is indeed national in scope, as you noted, and I guess arguably at times international when that work takes you into Canada. So do you find that there are pockets of people scattered around who, like me, aren't aware of Red Rover, even though you're 30-some years in?
Yeah, it seems like where we do disaster work, we're a little bit more well-known. So areas where there's a lot of hurricanes, we do some work on disaster preparedness as well. So more people know about us where the disaster risks are really high.
Right. Okay. So, because that was the other question I wondered about, is if the nature of this in some ways is that even folks that may have been assisted either directly or indirectly by Red Rover may themselves may not be as familiar with the organization as they should be.
Yes. And I think, you know, we have such a special niche in some of the areas where we work that we're very well known, for example, in the domestic violence sector, or at least that's growing, because it's a very specific program that works to help domestic violence victims escape their abusive situations with their pets. So, you know, we're doing a lot of outreach to that specific community, so we're becoming more well-known there.
Well, I definitely want to get into some other programs that Red Rover offers, and very much obviously including that one in a moment or two. But since we're sort of talking about the patchy maybe name recognition, I guess some of that also could be reasonably attributed to the fact that your organization operated under an entirely different name until 2011. So that's just seven years. So your organization was originally called United Animal Nations. And in fact, while its founding predated your tenure, maybe this is a good time to address some history. Tell me a little bit about United Animal Nations, how it was started and by whom. Nicole?
Can you hear me? Sorry.
Yeah, you dropped out there.
Sorry, my car switched to Bluetooth for there for a moment.
Okay.
here, I'll make sure it doesn't happen again. So when we were United Animal Nations, our scope was a lot broader. They were doing work internationally and helping all different kinds of animals. We even had a globe as a logo. And we helped, you know, everything from orangutans to whales. It was really, really broad. And okay. It was back in the 80s when there were a lot of animals in crisis, you know, different issues. And so as the animal welfare movement grew, we really narrowed our focus to animals in crisis, in natural disasters, and areas where we felt like there was really a big need. And so United Animal Nations eventually just became a name that was not fitting. And the founder really envisioned, with the name, envisioned a lot of animal groups coming together. So the original values of the organization were very collaborative, and that we still maintain to this day. Or, you know, we love working with other nonprofits and agencies and, you know, communities. And so that original vision of kind of this United Nations for Animals and for animal groups, we still, you know, have that collaborative spirit. But our focus, our programs are much more narrow.
Yeah. Well, again, just the name United Animal Nations, I mean, sounds pretty lofty. So I could see how, in addition to what you've described about sort of the maybe too broad a portfolio there, that in some ways that name probably was best retired, even if, like you say, the sensibility is still intact.
And it really didn't fit the organization, too. You know, we're very, the organization works so closely with people who are in crisis. You know, we talk on the phone a lot with people. We have a very, you know, warm and collaborative and, you know, this positive spirit of the Red Rover brand wasn't shining through in United Animal Nations. So ever since we changed our name, we've had all these corporate, you know, businesses interested in working with us. So we had a partnership with Russell Stover. We have a partnership with a cosmetic company that doesn't test on animals called Too Faced. And it's like we're getting a lot more interest in our brand, and that's really helping animals.
Yeah. Well, so just one more thing on the name. So I could see why, again, the United Animal Nations, that for a variety of reasons, really needed to sort of be retired. But how did you guys arrive at Red Rover as the replacement name?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was such a fun process. It was really amazing because I really felt like the name was holding us back, and so changing the name for me was a really you know, something I was very, very passionate about. But it was also a pretty stressful time to, you know, what name we're going to choose.
Yeah.
And so, you know, our volunteers, we have 4,000 volunteers all over the country, and they were calling themselves the Red Shirts. So they themselves had kind of branded themselves as the Red Shirts, and we love the color red because it has this, you know, emergency. American brings up the American Red Cross. It brings up a very passionate warmth. And that's really what the organization is all about. So red pretty quickly became a color that we were like, you know, this red feels really, really good.
Yeah.
And then trying to find something that was memorable and that people would, it would stick in your brain. You know, it's something people can remember easily. And Red Rover, you know, there's lots of connotations that people have with Rover, of course, because it's a dog's name. And, of course, we're way more than about just dog. But we were okay with that initial connotation of a dog. And then, of course, the kids' game, Red Rover, Red Rover, send us right over. That also has a nice, warm, positive connotation, although apparently it's banned at some schools. But
okay.
We won't go into that.
Yeah.
But it still has a, you know, we also have an education program that helps kids. So the idea of a kind of a childhood game is a good connotation to start with as well. And in the same way that, you know, when people hear of Amazon now, they don't think of the Amazon River or anything. You know, you once you get to know the organization or the brand, you associate it with what the organization is all about. And for us, Red Rover, you know, we're always on the move. We're always on the lookout for animals in crisis. And we're a warm, positive organization. So for us, the name Red Rover, we had a branding consultant help us, and it was one of their choices. And it was resisted pretty strongly because it seemed so different from other animal groups. It wasn't an acronym. We did not want an acronym. And so we really had to fight people who didn't want to change. But everyone who resisted, you know, eventually was like, oh, I get it now. And we've been, you know, growing pretty quickly ever since the name change kind of sunk in.
And that name change, I want to say, was in 2011, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're 7 years or so in. It's an interesting notion about steering away from acronyms and steering away from a number of other things and sort of drawing the parallel to, say, Amazon, which, of course, now it's universally understood. Yeah, at the time, it didn't necessarily suggest what it does or what it is. And I would say that at least early on, perhaps Red Rover, even with all the thinking, all the associations you've described, described didn't necessarily, well, certainly doesn't necessarily suggest particularly an animal group or one that's involved with rescuing and sheltering
right.
and that kind of thing. So,
right.
so it isn't.
Tagline help, you know, having our tagline, bringing animals from crisis to care.
Yeah.
You know, we always have that with our logo, so that
sure.
helps bring in the animal piece. And then once people have gotten to know us, you know, they certainly remember it.
Then very it becomes people. Second nature, yeah. like you yeah. kind of suggest over time, for sure. So this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Nicole Forsythe, president and CEO of Red Rover, a Sacramento-based national organization dedicated to rescuing and sheltering animals in crisis, amongst other agenda items. If you'd like to ask Nicole a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So let's spend a moment or two focusing on you, Nicole. When did you join the organization?
I started in 2006. So it's been, I just had my 12th year anniversary.
Okay, so you basically came in as president and CEO.
There was a previous CEO who had been, actually they changed the CEO quite a bit before I started. So
right.
I'm the longest CEO they've had.
Right, but in other words, you weren't involved with the organization in some other capacity. You,
right.
you sort of came in at that level.
Yes.
Okay. And what drew you to the organization? I mean, what did you find compelling about it back then?
I loved the focus on individual animals. You know, the idea that every animal matters and, you know, the care and attention we're able to give to every animal, you know, whether it's doing a disaster response and the you know, our volunteers are, they know that their job is to go in there and make the animals feel less stressed in a crisis. And just, you know, giving a lot of attention to one specific animal and recognizing, you know, the value of that life and the value of the human-animal bond, you know, just the kind of power that has and that value it has in our lives to make us aware of others and to feel kind towards others, whether they're people or animals. I just think there's a lot of potential in that relationship and how we treat animals to make society better. And that's kind of my passion right there.
And also, you brought to Red Rover a pretty varied background. Can you discuss that a bit and how your educational and professional paths ultimately delivered you, I guess, to the doorstep of
yeah.
what would become Red Rover?
Yeah, so I used to be a teacher. And again, you know, I'm all about changing the world and changing the future. And I think that getting kids to be more aware of things is a really powerful way to change the future because, you know, you're not working against some stuck biases. You know, you're really working from the ground up. And so to me, education is huge. So when I started with the organization, I really looked to figure out, is there a program we can develop that will really make a change in kids, in their attitudes towards animals and how they treat them. And so my background in education was instrumental in the development of our Red Rover Readers program, which really is working with kids at a very root level, you know, looking at what are the root causes of animal neglect and cruelty, and a lack of empathy is a huge one. And so developing a program that helps kids develop skills for empathy is great. It's very, again, one of my biggest passions. And so that program is rapidly growing. We're going to be having a partnership with Scholastic this fall that's going to help us expand it starting in California on a big scale. And so seeing that grow has been huge. And my background in education really helps that develop. And then I also have a science background. So I have a degree from UC Davis in animal behavior. Well, it was animal biology, but I had a big focus on animal welfare and behavior. And so for me, having a really solid understanding of animal behavior has helped the Red Rover Readers program, because we really are looking to help kids understand animal behavior, because you can't feel empathy if you can't understand what emotional state, you know, an animal might be expressing, and you need to be able to determine that based on behavior. So helping kids understand animal behavior, my background in the science has helped that develop that curriculum as well.
Yeah.
And also just, I really believe in science, in advocacy, or in any program you're trying to do, you know, getting to making sure the information we convey is as accurate as possible And bringing a lot of validity and credibility to animal welfare is also a passion of mine.
For sure. So again, as I noted before, you have a varied background. When you came in as president and CEO in 2006, was there a certain vision you had for the organization reconfiguring its priorities? Obviously, you've introduced new programs, some which we'll hopefully get into in more detail in a moment. Did you obviously take a look at what was then not Red Rover, but was about to become Red Rover, and say, okay, well, this is great. There's all kinds of potential here, but here's how I think it needs to be reshaped.
Yeah, I mean, I think it evolved fairly slowly over the time I've been there. You know, a lot of staff and board directors have brought together a shared vision.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely wouldn't say I've done this alone by any means.
Of course.
I am all about brainstorming ideas, and we're constantly changing. I think that was one of the things I observed about the organization as soon as I started, was just, you know, working in crisis situations, we never knew when we were going to get a call to respond to a disaster.
Yeah.
And so everyone was super flexible and agile and, you know, changed on a dime. And it was just amazing to see an organization that had that kind of flexibility. And that also really resonates with how I work well. I would not be in an organization for 12 years if I didn't find it constantly challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And this organization is constantly on the lookout for ways to improve and innovate and change. And I think part of that, our culture for that came from this ability to respond quickly to disasters. And so as new staff have come on and as new board directors have come together, we've really created a shared vision. And that is one where, you know, that human-animal bond is as respected as a parent-child bond. And just really strengthening that human-animal bond, you know, helping animals in immediate crisis and bringing a lot of awareness to the power of that connection.
So you've noted that much of Red Rover's work involves stepping in when a major natural disaster like a hurricane hits an area and has major implications for animals. And then you've noted that kind of has spilled over into other aspects of their operation. So how does Red Rover decide when to deploy to the site of a given disaster? I mean, who makes that decision? Is it you? Is it a combination of people? How does that work?
That's a good question. Yeah, so we, because we are so collaborative and we always work with the agency that is, in charge of a particular disaster. So sometimes that does mean you have to wait for that call. We do outreach. We let people know we're available to help. But ultimately, in a natural disaster, you know, sometimes the animal issues come after the people issues. So there's sometimes some waiting involved. And then we go in and respond at the request of a particular organization. So sometimes that's a government organization. Sometimes it's the actual animal shelter that's been put in charge of the response. So, for example, with Hurricane Harvey, we went in at the request of the Texas SPCA, and they were setting up a shelter in Dallas next to a human evacuation shelter. So we were able to set up our animal shelter right, very close to the human shelter so that the people could come visit their pets. And that was amazing. It was such a relief for the people to see that their animals were really well cared for and that they could go visit them as a source of comfort. So, you know, for us, that's the ideal kind of emergency response.
Sure.
But making that decision about whether we go or not, you know, usually it's our director of field services, Beth Gammy. She's the one who, you know, evaluates the situation. And then I pretty much rubber stamp it. So we have an amazing staff and they're highly competent. And so, you know, my job is really just to make sure they have the support that they need to get the job done.
And when you were describing, for example, what happened with Harvey and Texas SPCA asked you to come out and setting up the animal shelter near where humans were, it reminded me that I wanted to ask you, I mean, what largely, I guess, is a rhetorical question, but maybe you can just sort of elaborate on it, is to what extent Katrina permanently changed the landscape of responding to a significant mm-hmm. natural disaster that had tremendous impact on animals? I mean, is there everything sort of like there's pre-Katrina in this realm of work and then post-Katrina? I mean, is it that?
Oh, Katrina, yeah. Katrina made a huge, huge impact. You know, when we were involved with Hurricane Katrina, we had several shelters set up through that area. And we were one of the few national organizations that were doing animals in disaster work on a regular basis. And so when it was just chaos, when everyone else started to jump in,
yeah,
because they hadn't been doing it and it wasn't necessarily following the incident command system that, you know, government agencies are following. And so it was a little bit of chaos. And so we actually initiated calls with all of the different animal groups that were involved, which is amazing. Here we are, this little tiny group, you know, this relatively small organization, getting together all these other big national groups to say, hey, we need to coordinate what's going on here. And so we started these calls. And that really helped to kind of bring a little bit more organization, although, you know, at that point it was pretty chaotic, no matter what. But after that, those calls turned into the National Animal Shelter Rescue and Sheltering Coalition, NARS. And so we were a founding member of that organization, and that still exists today. And that has been hugely impactful for animal and disaster work, because these calls happen as soon as there's a disaster that we think is going to require, you know, multiple resources. And we all talk together about, okay, you know, who needs what, where, you know, where do they need this, where do they need that? And so it helps coordinate natural disasters. And American Red Cross and FEMA and, you know, PetSmart Charities, all these other organizations are a part of these calls so that we really can get a better sense of where things are best needed.
Sounds like really that, again, with the chaos that you mentioned, Katrina, and yet you guys had already done a lot of that work. So, but it sounds like through Katrina and beyond, and you know, establishing these organizations nationally, et cetera, there really is much more of a protocol, which seemed like was one of the many things completely lacking when Katrina hit. So,
yeah, one of the really great things that I've seen happen, even just over the last few years, is how in a particular community, the local shelters will very quickly get their own population of animals at the shelter transported out to other shelters so that they're ready to take in the disaster populations. And when that didn't happen, maybe even 5 years ago, that wasn't happening. And now it happens very, very quickly. So, you know, California with the wildfires, because they're so common, we're often not needed, you know, at all, because the local, you know, fires happen pretty quick. You know, you know whether you've lost your home or not pretty quickly. And so the evacuations are fast. They're probably a day or two. And then, some, you know, unless it's really raging out of control, typically people can go back. So just getting the animals out of a local shelter to other shelters can free up, you know, space for them to be evacuated there.
And so I would think, whether it's there or hurricane things, including Harvey that you mentioned and others, that generally that animals do get reunited if they've been separated and all the disaster itself and the chaos with their humans pretty readily now, again, because there's structure, because there's a protocol. Is that right, or is that generally now how that's working in the face of these kinds of disasters?
Yeah, and I think it depends on the disaster and how readily people think to bring their animals with them, and also if they've got difficult population of animals. So horses is pretty challenging to evacuate, and so there's definitely populations of animals that are still a challenge. And then I think with tornadoes and hurricanes, those areas that still get many, many warnings for hurricanes, it's a little bit of a psychological block every time you have to evacuate. Is this a real one?
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, depending on the community and the area and what kinds of disasters they're used to, how likely someone's going to evacuate their animals is still a potential problem. And that's usually what leads to the need for the in the field rescue. And that's not something, you know, we do. We really focus on the sheltering piece where people have evacuated with their animals or the animals have been rescued, and then we help, you know, set up a shelter. We work in partnership with a lot of other organizations too. So with Hurricane Maria, those animals were actually from Puerto Rico. They were actually flown out of the area and they went to St. Hubert's in New Jersey, and then we helped take care of the animals there once they had been rescued and, you know, brought to that particular animal shelter. So, you know, every disaster is a different model,
sure,
you know, of what was the greatest risk to those animals.
Right, and it also seems to bring a different set of questions. I mean, certainly with Irma and others, but I guess that particularly comes to mind for me. I just saw a lot, like on social media and elsewhere, just because people here in this area and you know, neighboring areas were evacuating. And just even the question of, like, you know, hotels and What if they don't have a pet policy, or can you insist? And those things, unfortunately, are still uncertain for people who are like in a crisis mode themselves. They're evacuating at that moment. And they do know now, like you alluded to, that they don't want to leave their pets behind. They want to take them. But then the question is, where are they going to go if they don't have a shelter themselves to go to? And if they are going to go to a hotel, can they insist that hotel take their pets? I mean, there just seemed like there was a lot of questioning about that I saw in the wake of Irma and other storms.
Yeah, and I think things are slowly changing, and some communities are changing more quickly than others. We've seen a lot of communities, you know, airlines were letting people fly with their pets, and so it really does depend on you know, the specific community how ready they are to change to allow pets, and that's something that we've been having our eye on. You know, how can we encourage a little bit more pet friendly spaces, especially in disasters?
Sure. So you mentioned earlier in our conversation, when we were talking about the evolution of the name, that there are 4,000 volunteers, I guess, maybe scattered across the country. So how did Red Rover develop such a large pool of volunteers?
Yeah, over the 30 years, just holding workshops. We do in-person workshops, and we do them in communities most at risk for disasters, or, you know, that also have the most interest in becoming volunteers, and just these one workshop after another, it's really grown, and they're very loyal and they stick with us. You know, we do surveys to make sure people are still ready to respond, because it could be years before someone is asked to help
based
on location. And so it's amazing to me that these people are so dedicated and so loyal, and we do such a great job of kind of making sure they know what to expect and doing these daily debriefs. And then also, you know, calls after the deployment is over, that also really helps them understand that we want them to have a really positive experience. It's often life-changing for people when they go through this, and they make really, you know, like-minded friends when they've deployed with some of the other volunteers. So it's a pretty amazing program to see. It's amazing what these volunteers do.
For sure.
It's not glamorous work, you know. They're cleaning cages, scooping poop, and maybe they get to hang out with some animals, but a lot of it's mostly physical labor.
Yeah. Again, this is Talking Animals on Duncan Strauss. My guest is Nicole Forsythe, President and CEO of Red Rover, a Sacramento-based national organization dedicated to rescuing and sheltering animals amidst hurricanes and other natural disasters, and other programs that we're going to get into in a moment or two. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Amidst that gigantic, or it seems like a gigantic pool of 4,000 volunteers, are some categorized by expertise or certain tasks that they're particularly adept at, or even just geography, or how does that work with such a large number like that?
We primarily focus on geography, so we try to get people as close to the situation as we can. But then we also have, you know, notes on people who maybe have more horse expertise, or know rabbits really well, or, you know, whatever the specific situation that we might be going into. So we know we have some people who are going to be familiar and can do some of the direct animal handling. But, you know, typically it really doesn't matter. We have team leaders, so we also do have a special pool of trained volunteers who can take over if our staff are not available. And so they basically are coordinating the volunteers, and they serve as volunteer leaders.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a one special pool of people. But other than that, everyone's pretty much doing the same job. You know, we have veterinarians and vet techs, but often they may be doing the exact same job, you know, as other volunteers would be doing, just because usually the agency where we respond has a veterinarian, you know, local veterinarian, or has those pieces in place already, although that varies too.
Yeah, well, in fact, I was going to ask you about vets, because it seems like there's quite a large squad of veterinarians as well that are affiliated with Red Rover, and I guess are readily able to deploy as, again, the situation calls for.
Yes, there's definitely some in our volunteer pool. They just may not necessarily be needed for that, for the role of veterinarian.
I see. Oh, I see. So that's a pretty versatile volunteer then. They can just do what's needed and clean a cage, or they can do some kind of medical procedure if need be. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, there's different policies regarding whether veterinarians can train across states. So sometimes they just may not be able to act in their capacity.
Right. That makes sense. Of course. Yeah. So one thing you touched on earlier that I absolutely wanted to come back to in more detail is the Red Rover Readers Education Program.
Yeah.
So can you just talk a little bit more about what that is and how that works and sort of the age range of the students that would typically participate in it?
Yeah. So it's a program that really sets us apart from other groups working in humane education because it's really getting to the empathy. So we're using stories and curriculum that focuses on discussion questions that really help children pull out how an animal might be feeling in a particular story. And most of them are based on illustrations. So for example, the book Buddy Unchained, it's a dog who's left on a chain. And, you know, in his behavior, you can tell he's sad and he's lonely. And so that's what we do. We ask the kids, you know, how do you think Buddy feels in this picture? And how do you know? So it helps them pull out the animal behavior they're observing and also talk about emotion. So it's in a lot of ways, it feels like mini therapy with these kids because they're really thinking about an animal's perspective. They're thinking about the human and the animal characters, and they're relating to their own lives and how they've interacted with animals. So we've seen profound changes in these kids where they, you know, they read that book and they go home and they tell their relatives, oh my gosh, I think we should take, you know, our dog off a chain, like he's probably really sad and lonely, and I've never thought about it before.
Mm.
So, you know, getting to that, that's what you want. You know, you want to get to these kids when they're like, wow, I have never thought about this before, and I don't want to be like that in my, you know, I don't want to treat animals that way. They have to make that decision to really change their behavior. And so we go in there, we don't judge the way the kids have treated animals. We just say, you know, what do you guys think? How do you think they should be treated? And so they come up with their own conclusion about how they think animals should be treated. And to me, that's, you know, the best way to get behavior to change. And so we train teachers as well as humane educators and other volunteers, you know, how to use this curriculum. It's a 5-week series, but we have more than 5 books. So we've got over a dozen books that we use in the program. And they all focus on animal behavior and a bond between a person and an animal. So kids can really see, you know, what does this bond look like? And, you know, what does friendship with an animal look like? How can you be friends with an animal? You know, what's different about being friends with an animal than a person? And we also have a new app. And so we have a way that people can access the program for free. Google Play and Amazon and Apple, they'll have the app. It's called The Restricted Adventures of Raja. And there's 2 books in the series now, Raja Book 1 and Raja Book 2. And they can be downloaded for free. And it has a book in, you know, in the app along with the kinds of questions that we ask. So a parent can sit down with a kid, download the app. It's for ages 7 to 11, the app. And that is a really good sample of what it's like to go through the program and have the kids, you know, look at the animal behavior and be able to determine, you know, how do I think that animal feels and how do I know? And then the regular program has illustrated picture books, and that can go from everywhere from kids in kindergarten up through 5th and 6th grade. That's pretty versatile.
Wow, that's great. And I love the idea of that app that makes it wherever anybody is can participate on some level within that 7 to 11-year-old range, which I just love the idea of cultivating empathy and just having that kind of thinking opened up, you know, for kids that age or obviously younger too. But that's just a great way to kind of steer them on the right course. So in our final moment or two, you also alluded to the program that helps address domestic abuse and the way animals figure into that. Can you speak to that a little bit more?
Yeah, so that's been an area that's been growing for us. I think the awareness of the role that animals play in domestic violence is growing, and it's pretty huge. So a lot of victims of domestic violence, you know, they won't leave their abusive situation because the animals in the house are actually being used in the abuse. So someone might be saying, if you leave, you know, such and thing is going to happen to the pet.
Yeah.
And so we really want to make sure that people have the ability to escape their situations. And if pets are an obstacle, we want to make sure that we can help with that. And so we offer, you know, very quick emergency temporary boarding. So we offer grants. So if someone needs to get out quickly, we can pay for their animal to be at a boarding facility. And that's not ideal because you hope that they can stay with them, you know,
yeah,
with the pets. And so we're working with the domestic violence shelters themselves to help encourage them to build on-site facilities for pets. And so we offer grants, you know, throughout the country to help them, you know, develop a program where they can either house them there, you know, on-site, or develop some resources in their community to house them closer. And so that's been tremendous. The program is growing, the size of the grants are growing, and we're getting a lot of interest. It takes them a while, you know, to kind of convince their own organizations that this is easier to do than they think. I think that's the biggest surprise that these shelters have, is that it's not as hard as they think. We have a manual that's online that was developed by Allie Phillips, and so she's got this great manual, and it really helps people walk through everything they need to be worried about in setting one of these up.
This is so important, and just sort of coincidentally, my guest on the show next week will be the CEO of a domestic violence center in nearby Pinellas County, and they, with the same exact philosophy that you just outlined in mind, recently opened an on-site kennel. So again, removing that key obstacle that often prevents people from leaving an abusive relationship because they won't leave their pets behind, but they often don't have anywhere to go with the pets. So anyway, extremely important. So that sounds just like great, great work. So we're in our final moment or two, Nicole. So in the 12 years that you've been leading Red Rover, I mean, what would you point to as kind of the couple of the bigger accomplishments, either programs that you've implemented, some which we probably discussed, or just other achievements just in terms of rescuing and sheltering, or just anything that sort of strikes you in that way?
Well, I think the name change, as we mentioned earlier, was real huge for the organization, and just being able to really develop that Red Rover Readers program because of the potential for just changing how kids and how, you know, when they grow up to be adults, how they're going to treat animals. I think that's probably been, you know, some of our biggest accomplishments.
Yeah. Oh, okay, that's it? No, sorry, I didn't know if there might be anything else you might want to cite.
Oh, there's just been so many individual stories.
Yeah, okay.
I could go on and on with the various stories of where we've helped. But just, you know, having the stories that help highlight the value of the human-animal bond. I can think of, you know, one where we helped this young veteran who had a post-traumatic stress disorder and had a dog that was helping him. And he ended up needing surgery, and then the dog ended up needing an emergency medical treatment. And that's one of the programs we haven't talked about yet, but we also help, you know, low-income individuals pay for emergency vet care. And so helping that young veteran with his, he had a pit bull who was his therapy dog who literally had saved his life. Like, he had stopped him from committing suicide. It was just this amazing, profound story of
how
much a relationship with an animal can literally save your life. It was such a moving story. And to know that we had a hand in helping make sure his dog was going to be there for him was pretty huge. And there's just, you know, dozens and dozens of stories like that. So I could go on forever.
No, it's so great. And those are exactly, that's kind of more what I was seeking, as well as the overall things like name changes, something like the veteran, and just how much, especially battling PTSD symptoms, et cetera, just, yeah, how much that dog meant to him and means to him, and just making sure that everybody is well looked after medically, et cetera. So let's try one more call before we might have to say goodbye. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Nicole Forsyth. Okay. Well, either it's a problem with the phone line, or maybe it's a problem with this particular line, but I don't. Caller, one more chance. Hello. Question or comment for Nicole Forsyth? Okay. So, all right. Well, Nicole, this sounds really wonderful. Again, we've been speaking with Nicole Forsyth of Red Rover. Again, the website is redrover.org, and there's we covered, I think, a good amount of ground, but there's so much else that Red Rover, in whatever incarnation, has done over many 30 plus years plus, and a lot of that's really detailed on this really great and extensive website. So again, it's redrover.org. Nicole, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, and all the great work you've done on behalf of animals and their humans.
Thank you for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
In a few moments, I'll speak with Chris Rusnak of Nature's Classroom about their annual Woods, Water, and Wildlife Open House happening this Saturday, April 28th. Right now, though, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner. So last weekend, I was in Austin catching some of the Moon Tower Comedy Festival, a fantastic multi-day stand-up and podcast extravaganza booked by my wife. A little plug there. Anyways, we're going to hear from one of the Moon Tower performers, Martha Kelly, who, as you'll hear, has moved back and forth between Austin and L.A. multiple times. You might also know her from the TV show Baskets, where she stars alongside Zach Galifianakis and Louis Anderson. This is Martha Kelly with a piece called Animal Road Trip in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
One of the four times that I've moved from LA to Austin, I drove there with my four cats and my dog in the car. And I rented a giant SUV and I put these big kennels in the back for the cats where I had food and water dishes and litter boxes and blankets. But even with all those amenities, there were a lot of angry accusations coming from the back of the car for a couple hours. And then it just got completely silent. And that made me kind of nervous because I didn't know if maybe they were planning something. So I just pulled over and I called a family meeting and I just... I explained to the cats, like, I know that this drive across country is difficult, but living in Austin again is gonna make life better for all of us. And there is no in team. So.
That was Martha Kelly with a piece called Animal Road Trip, taken from a performance on Comedy Central. Okay, on to Chris Rusnak to hear about the Nature's Classroom open house this Saturday. This is Chris Rusnak back on Talking Animals. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so we spoke sort of about this very thing about 3 years or so ago, but remind us what Nature's Classroom is and where it's located.
Yeah, Nature's Classroom has been around in Hillsborough County since 1969. We're right along the Hillsborough River where Fletcher turns into Morris Bridge Road, and we get all of the sixth grade students in public schools in Hillsborough County come out to see us for a 3-day field study.
Wow, that's a long tenure of that. So is it limited specifically to sixth grade students for that whole time, for all those years?
So it's been mostly our focus is the sixth grade, and there's about 17,000 of them that will come this year. But we do have some ability to program for third through fifth grade students. Okay. And originally, it was 7th through 8th grade inner-city students back in 1969 itself. We really try to get everybody outside as much as we possibly can. It's a beautiful site.
So it sounds like it has shifted a little bit over those years, but it sounds like the real concentration is 6th graders. Is there a particular thing about where 6th graders are educationally, cognitively, to make that kind of the focus of visiting Nature's Classroom?
Yeah, we just found it works best. They're at that right mindset where they can take all this really cool stuff in, and they're, you know, still really enjoying being outside, whether it's a new experience for them or an old one. We just have found that grade is just about the perfect time to have them out here.
Give us kind of the lowdown on what all is going to happen at the open house this Saturday.
Yeah, so the open house is one of our fundraisers we use to help feed all our animals. We have things like black bears, Florida panther, white-tailed deer. And what it's designed to do is just let people come on out and enjoy some time outside. We'll be selling some food. We'll be taking people on guided hikes. There'll be some opportunities to go down and catch some creatures in the river with nets for some lucky kids. We'll have a fundraising raffle. We'll have environmental exhibitors who are focused on natural resource education, all kind of things like that to enjoy. We'll have snow cones and popcorn and things like that. And they'll have a chance to go see all of our animal collection, the bears, the panthers, our bobcats, our alligators. And there'll probably even be a snake or two out and about for people to pick up and hold and have a good experience like that.
Wow. So everybody can be kind of a sixth grader for the day in Nature's Classroom.
Absolutely. And it's very family friendly. We've got some children's activities, some fun stuff for them to take home. And yeah, we really just want to have people come outside, enjoy the outdoors, see what's been happening these last almost 50 years we've been in existence.
Yeah. And so if someone were, you know, driving around or just otherwise wanted to get a few more details that they couldn't get at this moment, is there a Facebook event page or somewhere online where they can get kind of the details of where this is and the hours, et cetera, of the event?
Absolutely. There's two things they could do. They could check our website, which is Nature's Classroom, that's all one word, .mysdhc.org, or they could call our office at 987 6969 and just talk to our secretary. She'd be glad to give them any information they needed.
That's great. Now, one other question on sort of a slightly darker note, Chris, since we spoke 3 years ago, there was this kind of pretty awful story, I think it was deep into 2016, where these deer that were living there were attacked. Whatever became of that? Were the perpetrators ever found? And what else can you sort of just update us on that story?
Unfortunately, no. And it has definitely led to some very generous people in the public have donated and kind of helped update our security systems and cameras and things like that. So unfortunately, I have no good news there, but our animals are very much secure, and we very much appreciated the help from the public updating all our security.
Okay, well, sounds like things are much better, and a sort of awful incident like that's never really sounds like likely to happen again, so that's good to know. So
yeah.
All right, Chris. Well, we'll look forward to the extravaganza again this Saturday, the 28th at Nature's Classroom, and sounds like it's going to be a wonderful time. Thanks for joining us to fill us in on it today on Talking Animals.
Absolutely. 9 to 3 on Saturday. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour, Midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott in the All Souls edition of It's the Music. Meanwhile, on this show, I want to just give you a quick animal announcement of an event that's coming up that you might want to mark your calendars for. Because people do love shuffleboard, do they not? Especially if it helps animals. Come on, well, can't beat that combo. So this is, I'm referring to Shuffle for Strays, an event put on by Friends of Strays. And it's a shuffleboard tournament taking place Sunday, May 6th at the St. Petersburg Shuffleboard Club. It's going to happen from 2 to 5 p.m. And so it's going to, again, be fun, and there'll be all kinds of other stuff going on there, food and drinks and family fun and stuff. So you can go to friendsofstrays.org and find out more if you want to get involved and get yourself signed up for the big shuffleboard tourney. Well, that sounds great. I'm Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. This is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. There'll be a prize, the newest edition of the Talking Animals t-shirt, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. Let's name that animal tune, Talking Animals. If you can name that animal tune, you'll get yourself a Talking Animals, spiffy new Talking Animals t-shirt. We have, meanwhile, just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Lori is up next with Radioactivity. I invite you to join me next week when my guest will be, as I alluded to in speaking with Nicole, Lariana Forsyth, CEO of CASA, an acronym that stands for Community Action Stops Abuse. That's the official domestic violence center based in Southern Pinellas County, and recently opened an on-site kennel. And again, that's kind of removing a key obstacle that can prevent people from escaping abusive relationships. They often will not leave their pets behind, but often they don't have any place to go with their pets, so this addresses that. So we'll speak with Lariana about that and other aspects of CASA next week on Talking Animals. Meanwhile, I invite you to visit TalkingAnimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there, too. There are also links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally. And follow me on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at TalkingAnimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond. Homegrown, handpicked music and news, community conscious radio. We'll catch up with you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.